So the present paper deals with the work by Themistius that survive only in Syriac translation and is only marginally figured in modern scholarship. The text is known as De Virtute and can be described as a narration of about 9,000 words that deal with philosophy, and with Cynic philosophy in particular. Given that the De Virtute is not well known, I shall first have a look at the text itself, and the handout contains a working translation of it. And in the second half of the paper, I will attempt to put the text in relation to Themistius' career and to the 4th century more broadly. The De Virtute survives in a 9th century Syriac manuscript of the British Library, but the translation is likely to date back to the 5th century. To find the text by a pagan author in Syriac translation is no big surprise. The same manuscript contains also the Syriac translation of another oration by Themistius, the De Amicitia, and the works by Plutarch of Chaeronea and Lucian of Samosata. Another Syriac manuscript of the De Virtute has been recently identified in the library of the monastery in St. Catherine on Sinai. This second manuscript, written in the 10th century, contains 4 excerpts from the De Virtute. The Sinai manuscript preserves better readings of the text, and the list of the variants is reported after the translation towards the end of the handout on pages 13 and 14. Before approaching the text of the De Virtute, however, it is necessary to appreciate that this is a translation, and there is the possibility that the text presents changes resulting from the conscious or unconscious agency of the translator. Given that the Greek original is lost, to identify these changes is, of course, a difficult exercise, but it is nonetheless possible to make some considerations. As I said, the De Virtute is preserved within a collection of Syriac translations of Plutarch, Lucian, and Themistius, of which the Greek original survive, and all these translations show a consistent editing process that the translators carried out on the text. In particular, among the major changes that we can see, the translators have omitted all references to religious paganism that they found in the originals, and this was certainly in view of a particular Christian audience. Similarly, the translators were willing to omit anecdotes about mythological characters such as Achilles, Agamemnon, and so forth. Conversely, the translators were especially interested in the moral advice that they could find in the text by Plutarch, Lucian, and Themistius, and did not hesitate to add a moral slant to the text, or to expand on existing aphorisms and maxims of an instructional character. On other occasions, the translators have intervened more strongly on the text, for instance by epitomizing entire passages, even when this process interfered with the overall argument of the text. It is thus important to be aware that the De Virtute is most likely to have undergone a similar process of editing. A short note about the style of the translation, since this will be necessary to understand the text. A remarkable feature of the De Virtute is the frequent use of a couple of words, usually synonyms, to express the same one concept. I have signaled this in italics in the translation, and so for instance in the first paragraph you see towards the middle gloom and fog, unburdened and not distracted, and then towards the end simple and direct. This is very common in the text. It would be useful to be able to say whether or not this stylistic feature is an introduction by the Syriac translator, because first it would help identify who the translator may have been, and second it would serve us better in order to understand the original Greek. But unfortunately, this is not always possible. On the one hand, Themistius himself often used couples of synonyms, and this brings him close to the style of late Roman prose writers, ranging from Plutarch to Imerius and Libanius. But on the other hand, the Syriac translator of the De Amicitia, the adoration by Themistius that survives in both Greek and Syriac, sometimes renders a couple of synonyms with 2 words, sometimes he renders it with only 1 word, and sometimes he renders a single word with a double translation. So it is difficult to always to decide. This brings us to the title of the oration, which reads Discourse by the philosopher Themistius on Virtue, that is the excellence of the soul. Now, virtue here is simply arete, a Greek loan word that does not seem to be especially common in Syriac, at least at this stage. I have been thinking about a possible Greek equivalent for excellence other than arete, and I'm grateful to Michael Griffin's suggestion of Christotes, but I would not be at all surprised if these were an addition by the Syriac translator. In fact, the Syriac word for excellence here, miathrutho, is used as a translation of arete in the Diamikitia, and could well have been an addition by the translator here. So either way, to take the title too seriously may be a dangerous exercise, since titles are already problematic in Greek manuscripts, and the transmission into Syriac simply provided extra room for change. Before proceeding, however, it may be worth spending a word about the authorship of the Virtute. No scholar so far has seriously questioned the manuscript's attribution to Themistius, and I would like to suggest that further analysis reveals strong affinity between the De Virtute and other orations by Themistius. This appears from a considerable number of linguistic and conceptual parallels between the De Virtute and other discourses by Themistius. Some of the most conspicuous ones are reported on the table at pages 15 and 16 of the handout. Here on the left is the Syriac text of the De Virtute, and on the right, references to other orations by Themistius. None of these parallels taken by itself is of course, decisive about authorship, but they overall show the extent of the overlap between the De Virtute and other orations by Themistius. What the table does not show is that often these parallels also appear in similar contexts. Other remarkably Themistian features of the De Virtute are the use of a fable by Aesop, as Themistius does in at least three other orations surviving among the private orations, and especially the use of an allegorical tale or simile that is stretched on and on for pages and pages, here is paragraphs 2 to 9, as Themistius does in at least three other private orations. And of course, I would be happy to provide the details. And of course, there are many other common rhetorical devices, but these are not especially Themistian, so they do not concern us here. So the text. The De Virtute is a philosophical oration, and the tone resembles that of many private orations by Themistius. So we will not be surprised to find a less academic approach to philosophy here than we find in the commentaries. Themistius is, of course, not the first person to compose orations with philosophical subjects, and certainly Dio Chrysostom was an important point of reference, together with Plutarch and possibly Maximus of Tyre. This is how the De Virtute begins, and I shall read the beginning. They who believe that there is something superior to virtue, which is the excellence of the soul, should cleanse their hearts from this opinion as from dirt, and come after my words. On other occasions, I've already introduced you to the wisdom of Plato and of Aristotle, as you were able to understand, but many things were far from your understanding, and the road leading to them was long, full of many turns, uphill, and hidden in gloom and fog. It is not easy for anybody to walk on this road, not even when one is unburdened and not distracted by many things. But if one, through much toil, has acquired wisdom, he will be able to walk on it. But philosophy, since it is friendly to men and to those who are weary to walk on a long road or are hindered from walking by old age or by young age, shows them another road that is simple and direct. So Themistius is addressing a group of people, allegedly pupils or disciples, whom he has previously introduced to Plato and Aristotle. But there is, of course, the possibility that the audience was not limited to such students. He adds that he has already taught them the wisdom of Plato and Aristotle, but this was, in fact, only one of the roads that philosophy has shown men. That all philosophical traditions are deviations that do not depart much from the one main road, and they nonetheless reach their destination eventually, is an image that Themistius had already used to describe the philosophical views of his father in Oration 20. But here the message is slightly different, in that there is an alternative road altogether. This alternative road is simple and direct, and as the text goes on, it becomes clear that this is the sumptuous odos of the Cynic tradition, the shortcut to happiness that does not go through the study of many books. The second paragraph reveals what Themistius is about to do with his audience on this occasion. Today, then, if you follow me, I shall be for you, as I said, a guide on this road, for it is not easy or simple to go on a road like this. For I will not have to speak about philosophical teaching if I speak well about the road that I will say is simple. For I say that this road is simple, full of goods and prosperity, and on it no chariots, no mules, no supplies that wear out the travellers and hinder their eagerness unnecessary. But in order that you may follow me easily while I show how many differences there are from this road and those that were found by ancient philosophers, leading, as it were, to a port of prosperity. And here I think we should correct prosperity into happiness, since I'm now convinced that kainuto is a translation of eudaimonia, so these are roads leading to happiness. I wish to temper the beginning of my discourse with a pleasant demonstration, as the doctors do when they give a harsh medicine, for this mere honey and wine on the brim of the cup. Themistius will thus explore this scenic shortcut, and in order to do so, he shall use an allegorical tale that will go on now until the end of paragraph 9. In this allegorical tale, different philosophical traditions are described as roads that were found by past philosophers, but can be trodden by people today. So paragraphs 4 to 6 presents the road that Epicurus has found. Paragraph 7 describes the road that Aristotle has shown. And paragraphs 8 and 9 deal with the third road, the shortcut that Socrates first found, but then Antisthenes, Diogenes, and Crates made especially renowned. As you can see, the description of the first road, the one by Epicurus, is much longer than the other two, and it is conceivable that the translator abbreviated the text. However, to give an idea of the symbolism, we can have a look at the description of the scenic road from paragraph 8. But follow me, friends and companions, for since with our discourse we have ascended up to this place, a road has become visible to us as from a watchtower, and that road is shiny, plain, good, and easy. As it is said, first Socrates found this road, after him Antisthenes trod it, and then Diogenes and Crates, who especially glorified and made it renowned. Conversely, Chrysippus, Zeno, and Cleanthes began to go on this road, but later went astray and found themselves in the middle between Aristotle and Diogenes. This point about the Stoics will serve us later, so the Stoics, they go astray. The beginning of this road, so the Scenic Road, is difficult and rugged, but after a little, a bare and broad plain comes upon its traveller. Calm weather, clear sky, and tranquility dwell in it, and the land puts forth by itself the provisions that are necessary to them who go on it. The animal does not annoy them, for it is not alarmed or shy, nor does it drag them after itself, but they draw it whenever they want, and they feed it on flourishing meadows next to the edge of the road. They go intrepid, rejoicing, and enjoying goods on which the hands have not toiled. Therefore, the noise of beating silver coins is not heard on that road, nor does gold shine within their cargo, and these travellers alone are not grieved by the fear of robbers. Change and power do not descend on them from the fortresses, this refers to the symbolism that was described earlier, and if they ever descended, they would turn back with shame, having fallen upon men whom nothing subdues. So this is the scenic road. But despite the praise of it, Themistius makes his position somewhat clearer in the following paragraph. The example and the allegory of what I wanted to say has thus reached an end. Perhaps, however, you will ask me why I praise one road while I walk on another. Then I shall give you an answer, not in allegory, but openly, but do awake yourself and listen, for you shall not hear vain things. I intend to teach you, if I'm able, the many and various ways of this manner of life, in order that each one of you may choose for himself the ones that he can accomplish, and may thus live according to his strength, as it is better for him. This you shall learn, the philosophy, although it teaches that man follows and seeks one thing, well-being and beatitude, has not prepared one road for man, but many. Three of them are the ones that we have mentioned, which are renowned and before the others. Themistus then goes on to explain that each of these roads has indeed a purpose, and each of them can benefit different sorts of men, as is explained in paragraph 12. Then, since many things are done as good because of lack of knowledge, philosophy shows that the true good is, and acts like the doctors. For the doctors do not use one medicine and one nourishment for all bodies, but to the infirm in the stomach they give poultices and delicate foods, and to those who are thence closer to recovery they give robust foods and medicines. So also philosophy, when it has seen that a man is subdued to desires and believes that pleasure is the only good, persuades him to Epicurus that he should not disregard virtue and be led foolishly by desires, lest you, by going too far, end up, on the contrary, in what terrifies you, griefs, pains, and miseries. This is most likely a quotation which nobody has identified, so if anybody has any guess, a quotation would be very helpful. Conversely, when philosophy has seen another who praises virtue but does not praise it more than he praises health, wealth, and fame, he persuades him through Aristotle and shows that virtue is the chief good and more advantageous of all goods that are useful to the body and are found in the royal palaces. And there follow a more detailed explanation of how exactly each road can benefit men with different sorts of diseases. To find Epicurus here is perhaps less surprising than it seems at first, since according to Themistius, his father Eugenius too used Epicurus in his teaching, although removing him after a very short time, and this is Oration 20. After this section about how the different roads can benefit different sorts of men, Themistius feels that he has not done enough to impress his audience, and he launches on an especially remarkable virtuoso performance. All of a sudden, Themistius calls in three fictitious speakers who shall each pronounce a discourse in favor of one of the three roads in order to see which one will gain the victory, as if it were in a lawsuit. This section begins in paragraph 15. So, since it has been shown to you that philosophy itself is divided into three parts, and that it offers to the minds of men its medicines, allow me now to pronounce in front of you a speech on each of these three parts, and to say and find out how many within our gathering obey each one of these three parts. Come, all of you who love virtue more than the other goods. Come, all of you who extol virtue alone. Which of these voices do you most obey in your minds? I myself say that even if you do not acknowledge it, most of you obey pleasure. And so forth. Then the following paragraph. If you are at leisure, I shall put in front of you, as in a lawsuit, the people and the discourses that may speak in favor of these three roads of philosophy opposing one another, and we shall see which one of them receives the victory. And then let then the person who praises pleasures enter in front of us. So this is the Epicurean. He has now entered, having crafty arguments ready and leading a multitude of followers. He's boisterous, and within himself he trusts that the judge will not be so sagacious as to not grant him victory from the first word, as not to accept the good that he's about to show in front of him as the good with capital G. He then began from high above to praise pleasures with lengthy eulogies, saying, and the speech follows. They follow the speech of the second speaker, which is slightly shorter, so the Aristotelian. The third speaker, who defends Cynic philosophy, begins later in paragraph 23. And we can have a look at it in order to gain an idea of the argument. So the Cynic speaker says, I reckon that the good of man is what is his own, and I do not regard what he has acquired from outside as such. I regard man as blessed in these, that is to say, in what is his own. And if this is not so, we shall understand from other things. Whom do you call healthy? The one whom the effort of moderation is sufficient to keep healthy, or the one who needs medicine and many remedies to stay healthy? Again, whom do you reckon is faster, the one who surpasses runners on his feet, or the one who surpasses horsemen by riding a horse? It is not entirely clear, however, whether the speech in favor of Cynic philosophy ends with this paragraph, or, as I'm inclined to think, it goes on for another while until the end of paragraph 32. And the reason is because paragraph 32 says, but if you truly want to know the reason is an excellent thing, it is not Plato or Aristotle that call us witnesses, but the wise Antisthenes who found this road. And from 33, that's clearly Themistius' voice, because if, however, you're not persuaded by these men, lift up your gaze. So that's certainly Themistius. The end of the third speech marks the beginning of the second half of the oration, in which Themistius appears more determined and explains what virtue is and its role in the life of humans. He does so, however, without renouncing to familiar rhetorical devices, like direct questions to the audience, the reproduction of possible objections put forward by imaginary speakers, and the personification of Socrates and of the very virtue who are made pronounce short passages. This part of this discourse is richer in anecdotes and is more strongly moralizing, and it is possible that through translation some anecdotes have been omitted and some rephrased in order to make their instructional component more effective to the eyes of the Syriac translator. As a result, the overall argument may be slightly more difficult to follow. But in short, Themistius argues that vexations and pleasures are equal for the virtuous person, this is to say, the person who can govern himself. And virtue itself is not affected by external changes like poverty or disease, but it is present under any circumstance. Virtue is a sufficient condition to make a life a happy life, and it provides man with happiness, which in all likelihood was eudaimonia in the Greek original. Themistius explains that the person who seeks virtue should of course turn to philosophy, and this is paragraph 45, in which Themistius also points out that obviously he's not speaking about philosophy in order to be praised. In fact, philosophy provided past philosophers as models of virtuous behavior, and Themistius moves on to narrate a few anecdotes. One is about Heraclitus in paragraph 46, and another one is about the Cynic Crates, who trained himself in physical exercise, as is reported in paragraph 47. The closing section of the De Virtute, however, narrows down onto the role of the philosophers and his engagement with society. The most important aspect of the philosopher's behavior is a frank criticism, and the philosopher should play an admonitory and teaching role, as the Cynic Diogenes and Crates used to do. And this is paragraph 48. So if the circumstances demand that the philosopher should say a funny word of derision while he makes an accusation, he shall not take pains about how to ridicule so much as how to help, for under the cheerfulness of his word, an admonition should lie hidden, as it is in the words of Diogenes, in whose depth aid lay hidden and cheerfulness cover them. Then again, paragraph 49, then the philosophers must not feel shame when advising, for why should he who is a philosopher refuse to be outspoken? And 50, to kings and princes, their ranks provide the power to punish the evildoers. To the philosophers, the fact that they do not err gives them the power to chastise the evildoer. The argument is reinforced through anecdotes about the behavior of various philosophers until the very close of the oration. This overview should have given some idea of the contents of the De Virtute. What seems most unexpected, as far as I could see at least, is the fact that Themistius appears to be lending a hand to Cynic philosophy, which is not otherwise a prominent feature of his written work. In order to understand what exactly Themistius was doing with his oration, however, it would be necessary to have a better knowledge of the historical and cultural context, which unfortunately we do not have. The De Virtute provides no straightforward indication of chronology, and for this reason what I'm about to suggest from now on is a working hypothesis, and it would be very useful to hear if you have any thoughts about it. So, to begin with, I would like to share the observation by Heinrich Scholze, who back in 1911 published the first systematic chronological study of the orations by Themistius. He wrote that despite the fact that moral sentences of the De Virtute are not always that profound, this text is among the most accomplished orations by Themistius. Also, he argued that Themistius must have written it as an old man, experienced of life and of fortune, since, as a youth, he would not have presented himself as a teacher of virtue with the same warmth as he does here. In fact, Themistius say that he himself has already walked the three roads of philosophy, and that De Virtute would certainly make a greater effect if Themistius was now perhaps in his 40s or even 50s. Since he was born in 317, this would bring us to the late 350s and 360s, but this consideration, which seems plausible, is of course not a cogent argument. What I think is in greater need of explanation, given what we know about Themistius, is the subject of the De Virtute and Themistius' sympathetic view of Cynic philosophy, even at the cost of relegating Aristotle and Plato to the second position. At the same time, however, Themistius is clearly not rejecting Plato and Aristotle, and he makes this clear several times throughout the text. But nonetheless, on this occasion, he presents cynicism in a very positive way. In my view, in what circumstances Themistius may have done so is one of the first issues that the text poses. As far as I could see, there are at least two moments in the life of Themistius when Cynic philosophy was under the spotlight, and both occasions presented themselves in Constantinople. One is the spring of 362, when Emperor Julian pronounced two orations against two Cynic philosophers who, according to Julian, did not raise to the standard of Cynic philosophy proper. And the second occasion is the winter of 379-380, when Gregory of Nazianzus, the newly appointed bishop of the city, pronounced a panegyric oration for the Christian philosopher known as Maximus the Cynic. In short, I shall suggest that the spring of 362 provides an at least plausible setting for the De Virtute, and this is shown by some important overlaps between our text and the two orations by Julian. I'm not suggesting that the two orations by Julian and the De Virtute were performed in the same setting or that they respond directly to each other, but I'm rather suggesting that the overlaps make it hard to believe that the two authors were not aware of each other, and that it is possible to imagine some sort of dialogue between the De Virtute and Julian. So, to make a long story short, in November 361, Julian was in Naissus, in the Balkans, when he received the news that the other Augustus, Constantius II, just died for natural causes, thus preventing a civil war between the two of them. Julian was now the sole Augustus at the head of the Roman Empire, and he was 29 or 30 years old. A primary concern was to safeguard the trust of the army, but at the same time to install individuals loyal to him in key positions within the imperial administration. Both concerns went hand in hand with the conviction of a large number of high-ranking officials from the past administration of the Constantian regime. Among the first things that Julian did in November 361, however, was to write a letter to the Neoplatonist philosopher Maximus, who was at Ephesus, where he was running his own philosophical school. Julian asked Maximus to come to court as soon as possible, and he even provided him with public carriages and a couple of trusty servants for the occasion. According to the account by Eunapius, Maximus of Ephesus had been a fellow student of Julian in Pergamum from about 351, when they were both instructed in Neoplatonism and in theurgy under Idesius. Maximus was a brilliant student, more advanced than Julian, and possibly a mentor for him, and he soon moved to Ephesus to found his own philosophical school. Despite the pressure of Julian's letter, however, Maximus took it extremely easy, claiming that he should wait for favorable omens before leaving Ephesus, and joined Julian in Constantinople not before 3 or 4 months, thus missing also Julian's triumphant entry in the capital on December 11, 361. To wait for Julian in Constantinople was instead Themistius, who was about 44 years old at the time and had reached political prominence under Constantius. There is a strong possibility that Themistius had taught Julian when they both were in Constantinople and then in Nicomedia for Julian in the period 348-351. Julian would have been between 17 and 20 years old at the time and was yet to discover theurgic Neoplatonism that would later become so important for him. A few years later, when Julian was appointed as Caesar at the age of 24, or if we follow Peter Herder's suggestion from last week in 361, Themistius sent him a praising letter to congratulate his appointment as Caesar and to advise him about the active political life that was waiting for him. Unexpectedly, however, this letter provoked a hostile reaction in Julian, as is attested in Julian's response, the surviving letter to Themistius, about which I think Riccardo Chiaradonna will give a paper in a couple of weeks. Soon, however, Themistius composed another work, the Risala, in which he adopted a very different approach to Julian's kingship. In short, by the time Julian was appointed Augustus, Themistius must have been well aware that the accession of Julian would not have made his life any easier. For instance, Julian's direct and passionate involvement in the life of the Senate, of which we know quite a bit, must have certainly brought the emperor very close to Themistius' territory. At the same time, it is easy to see that a new young emperor with strong philosophical and religious sensibility could possibly provide unique career opportunities to professional philosophers and sophists, and the school edict of June 362 may well have resulted from very similar pressures. Among the new appointments to high government office that were aimed at erasing the Constantian past, Julian chose established professionals, but also a number of renowned intellectuals. And I just mentioned Celsus, a rhetorician pupil of Libanius who became governor of Syria. And Nymphidianus, who was the very brother of Maximus of Ephesus and a rhetorician by profession, who was made Magister Epistolarum Graecarum, this is to say the Secretary of State of the Greek-speaking part of the empire. It is possible that the dispute between Maximus of Ephesus and Themistius took place in these very months, in early 362, when the two of them, as well as Julian, were in Constantinople. The two philosophers found themselves in disagreement on an academic issue, the reduction of the syllogisms of the second and third figures, and in order to solve the contention, the very emperor was called in. Unfortunately for Themistius, however, Julian assigned the victory to Maximus, and to score a point against Themistius in Constantinople on the ground of Aristotelian logic must have been a particularly strong blow for our author. The treatise that Themistius wrote on the subject against Maximus has nonetheless survived in Arabic translation, and I have reported on the handout the short account of this event by Ammonius, which is on page 16 of the handout. It will be useful to hear what you think about the language that is used here, since it may well be that this was an actual debate taking place in front of the emperor, perhaps involving some staging and an audience, and I've seen that Peter Heather last week described it simply as a public debate. What we know beyond this particular event is that Julian did not shun involvement in philosophical affairs, and this seemed to have been a feature of the public profile that he did not mind for himself, well beyond his close intimates. As a reminder of this, I have reported on the handout the text of a Latin inscription from Pergamum. It is curious because it reads, Domino Nostro Flavio Claudio Iuliano, Domino Tutius Urbis, and already in the third line, Julian is identified as a Philosophiae Magister, a teacher of philosophy. As a successful statement from the regime of Constantius, and with a past as a teacher of philosophy in the capital, Themistius was one of those people whose ground was clearly under threat, and he was willing to do his best not to get into trouble, and if necessary, perhaps even to try new and extreme strategies. At the same time, the very young Julian was ready to react strongly against any patronizing attempt, for instance, by established or less established philosophers. And this brings me to the two orations by Julian that deal with Cynic philosophy. These two orations, together with the so-called hymn to the mother of the gods, are the only works we know that Julian composed as an Augustus while in Constantinople. The orations that deal with Cynic philosophy are Oration 7 to the Cynic Heraclius, which was pronounced in March 362, and the handout has some passages, and Oration 6 to the uneducated Cynics, which was pronounced at the beginning of June 362, just before Julian departed for the East. I will suggest that the De Virtute can be understood in the context that I have just outlined, and it might have been pronounced at some point between these two orations by Julian. Oration 7 was pronounced on a particular occasion as a response to a lecture delivered by the Cynic philosopher Heraclius. Heraclius had made a name for himself at the court of Constantius in Milan, and after Julian entered Constantinople, he presented himself in the capital, asking permission to deliver a lecture in the presence of the emperor, possibly in a misguiding attempt to gain his favor. Julian claimed to have yielded to this request only after much insistence by the Cynic philosopher, but only to be then shocked at the blasphemous words of Heraclius, who made up an allegorical tale that featured the god Pan as a symbolic representation of Julian, and no less than Zeus as a symbolic representation of Heraclius himself. Julian was of course furious, but he made use of this situation for a more ambitious enterprise. The following day he delivered a full-length lecture to set things straight, and this is Oration 7. Here Julian attacked Heraclius. He condemned the use of myth outside specific didactic and theological settings, and explained in detail under what circumstances mythology can be used. Julian's treatment of the subject is remarkably similar to that found in a theological treatise composed by the Neoplatonic philosopher Salutius, another friend of Julian who, by the way, just been promoted to Praetorian Prefect of the East. Also, according to Julian, the Cynic Heraclius did not raise up to the standards of Cynic philosophy, and in particular the standard of Diogenes, who, Julian argued, was an especially pious and religious man. Julian's attack is not limited to Heraclius, but it soon extends to the Cynic philosophers of his time, who do not follow Cynicism proper. In this context, Julian brings up the image of the Cynic shortcut to virtue, and this is passage on page 17 of the handout, so from about the middle part. Talking about Cynics, they adopt the contemporary Cynics. They adopt the stuff, the cloak, the long hair, the ignorance that goes with these, the impudence, the insolence, and in a word, everything of the sort. They say that they are traveling the short and ready road to virtue. I would that you were going by the longer, for you would more easily arrive by that road than by these of yours. Are you not aware that these shortcuts usually involve one in great difficulties? Despite the poor performance of Heraclius, however, Julian's take on cynicism, as it should be, is overall positive in the oration. And for instance, in the following passage, he explains what the shortcut, the Suntomos Odos, should actually be. Now, the true shortcut to philosophy is this, A man must completely come out of himself, recognize that he is divine, and not only keep his mind untiringly and steadfastly fixed on divine and stainless and pure thoughts, but he must also utterly despise his body. And later in the oration, Julian repeats the point that he has nothing but friendly feelings for really virtuous cynics. That is to say, those that understand cynicism like Julian himself does, if, however, there is any such cynic nowadays. In the second half of the oration, Julian provides an example of how myth can instead be used in a righteous and pious way, and he narrates a tale about his family and his ascent to power. The tale, as it soon becomes clear, is in fact a remake of a similar story reported in the first speech on kingship that Dio Chrysostom had pronounced in front of the newly proclaimed Emperor Trajan upon his installation in Rome in 98 AD. Julian, however, gloriously replaced the main character of the story, Heracles, with his young self. And, for instance, he recasts his own religious conversion and initiation in the terms of the tale of Heracles at the crossroads, which was ultimately the origin of this imagery of different roads that we have come across so far. And this is the next passage on the handout on page 18, which is worth reading. Then Hermes, who had an affinity for him, where him is Julian, appeared to him in the guise of a youth of his own age, and greeting him kindly said, "Follow me, and I will guide thee by an easier and smoother road as soon as thou hast surmounted this winding and rugged place where thou seest all men stumbling and obliged to go back again." Then the youth set out with great circumspection, carrying a sword and shield and spear, though as yet his head was bare. Thus, relying on Hermes, he went forward by a road smooth, untrodden, and very bright, and overhung with fruits and many lovely flowers, such as the gods love, and with trees also, ivy, laurel, and myrtle. The symbolic language is certainly not an invention by Julian, but it very much strikes for the similarity with the De Virtute, including the detail of the sword and the shield that in Themistius the philosopher was holding in paragraph 50. Julian clearly seems to imply that Dio Chrysostom, whom he mentioned explicitly, could be a suitable model to be imitating when addressing the emperor on formal occasions, unlike the cynic Heraclius did. In fact, cynic philosophy and especially literary traditions about Diogenes were an important source for Dio Chrysostom, who wrote at least four philosophical orations on Diogenes, and in his fourth oration on kingship addressed to Trajan, used Diogenes as the model of virtue for a righteous sovereign. And the oration itself is structured as a dialogue between Alexander the Great and Diogenes. In short, Julian seems to bring up, endorse, but also readapt the proper high tradition of Cynic philosophy as it could read in the orations by Dio Chrysostom. Now, if the De Virtute was pronounced after the oration against Heraclius, Themistius would be someone who has done the homework. He presents a sympathetic view of Cynic philosophy, and is extremely cautious not to infringe upon Julian's positive take on it. At the same time, however, Themistius provides a broader intellectual framework to understand and especially justify the existence of different philosophical traditions. Possibly, by arguing that every philosophical tradition has some practical use, he's also trying to safeguard a spot for himself and like-minded individuals in this new philosophical world put forward by Julian, in which cynicism was so prominent. The idea that each of the three roads represents a different philosophical tradition is now found in Oration 7 by Julian, and may well be an innovation of the De Virtute. In this scenario, Themistius' response to Julian would be, "You are entirely right, but wait a minute, in fact there are different philosophical traditions. One is Epicureanism, which is what it is. Another one was shown by Plato and Aristotle, but this is a dangerous road. And another one is the Cynic shortcut, which is hard at the beginning, but then becomes easy. And I praise it the most, but I'm not able to follow it, although it is surely the best." The three roads are not exactly exclusive, and in fact, philosophy acts like a doctor that treats different patients with different medicines. Last but not least, the behavior of the Cynic philosophers can be taken as a model of virtue, as Julian also argued, and it, of course, entails frank criticism. Now, if we look at Julian's Oration 6 to the uneducated Cynics, which was pronounced a few months later, it appeared that some arguments can be understood as a response to specific points that Themistius had made in the De Virtute. Oration 6 is presented as a reply to another Cynic philosopher who is not identified by name, but he's simply somebody coming from Egypt and with Christian sympathies. Julian attacks him directly, but again he does not miss the chance to deliver a lecture on philosophy, and a much more ambitious one than he had done with Oration 7. Julian aims to explain what philosophy is, and he soon moves on to argue for the fundamental unity of all the major Hellenistic philosophical traditions, including Cynicism, if they are rightly understood, and this overarching approach seems closer to the De Virtute. Julian's lecture is a very ambitious one, and ultimately argues that past philosophers were following the same Delphic maxim, gnothi se auton, know thyself, and that all major philosophical traditions, the Socratic, the Platonic, the Aristotelian, the Cynic, the Stoic, and so forth, sprang from this one precept of divine origin. One of the substantial arguments by Julian is the similarity in the philosophical doctrines by Diogenes and by Socrates. This was certainly not a novelty nor an invention by Julian, and Themistius in the De Virtute would certainly be on board, for he stated that it was Socrates who actually found the Cynic road, as he said in paragraph 8. Julian also seems to be less committed to Cynic philosophy now than he was in the previous oration, and in the next passage, 182c, he appears closer to Themistius when he argues that Cynicism is of course one branch of philosophy, but by no means the most insignificant or least honourable, but rivaling the noblest. Further below, the way in which Julian introduces the argument for the substantial unity of all philosophy, it is surprisingly close to the De Virtute, as one can see from the next passage. Therefore, I say, let no one divide philosophy into many kinds, or cut it up into many parts, or rather, let no one make it out to be plural instead of one. For even as truth is one, so too philosophy is one. But it is not surprising that we travel to it now by one road, now by another. There is then a little anecdote. And let no one try to refute me by pointing out that some philosophers in traveling by those very roads have been known to lose their way, and arriving in some other place have been captivated as though by Circe or the Lotus Eaters, that is to say by pleasure or opinion or some other bait, and so have failed to go straight forward and attain their goal. Rather, he must consider those who in every one of the philosophical sects did attain the highest rank, and you will find that all their doctrines agree. Now, let no one try, in Greek is me de tuto tis emin profereto, and that is unlikely to be the Cynic philosopher which is addressing the second person in the oration. So there is a possibility that Julian may be referring to Themistius here, since in the De Virtute both the Epicurean and the Plato-Aristotelian roads presented great dangers to the travellers, and these dangers are described using the same allegorical language. In addition, as far as the De Virtute goes, the philosophers who really went astray and did not have their own road were the Stoics. In paragraph 8 of the De Virtute, as we have seen. And it seems relevant that Julian here immediately moves on to argue that the Stoics too follow the same one philosophy as the text explains below as he proceeds in 185 C and D. But I shall not read this passage. It is thus conceivable that this is Julian's reply to the take on the Stoics reported in the De Virtute. What Themistius issue with the Stoics was, however, is another question, and perhaps you could help me here. Themistius' orations show some variance, since Stoic philosophy is at times condemned, while at times tolerated. And also, paragraph 13 in the De Virtute has something more about the ethics by the Stoics. However, it may be relevant here that in a passage of the letter to Themistius, Julian puts forward a condemnatory attitude against the Stoics on the issue of fate, and this might perhaps stand behind Themistius' hostility to the Stoics in the De Virtute. Then Julian's orations moves on to deal with the origins of Cynic philosophy, and of course he cannot accept the Socratic origin of Cynicism, as Themistius had put forward, since Julian argues all philosophy is not human, but rather divine, and it ultimately originated from Apollo. And here Julian claims to be following the view that Iamblichus had held. Julian then deals with Plato's philosophy and eventually addresses Cynic philosophy proper. Julian provides anecdotes about the behavior of Diogenes, some of which he had used in the letter to Themistius. That Diogenes despised wealth and was happy to live poor was well known, and we are not surprised to find similar remarks in the De Virtute too. Conversely, what Julian does for another Cynic philosopher, Crates, is more curious, since after remarking on his religiosity, he basically says, and this is the following passage 200b, well, now if you want to learn more about Crates, go and read the life that Plutarch has written, rather than learning superficially from me. Unfortunately, this life is now lost for us, but it is likely to have been abundantly used by Themistius in the De Virtute, which contains several anecdotes about Crates. The close of the oration is at least as unexpected, since here Julian argues that the Cynic philosopher should cross examining himself, but should very much limit frank criticism, as in the following passage, 201b, and freedom of speech he must not employ until he have first proved how much he's worth, as I believe was the case of Crates and Diogenes. And then there is an anecdote. Diogenes used to reprove them not harshly, but with a charming manner, and not so as to seem to persecute those whom he wished to reform, but as though he wished to be of use both to them and to the bystanders. Yet this was not the chief and end aim of those cynics, but as I said, their main concern was how they might themselves attain to happiness. The argument here is not self-evident, since hostile criticism was a tenet of the cynic tradition, while Julian seems to take the opposite view. Themistius had said that an exemplary behavior by the philosopher, even if silent, could be extremely effective, but he had also gone a considerable length to argue for freedom of speech for the philosophers and for their chastising function in the closing part of the De Virtute. Conversely, Julian argues that criticism is only an incidental feature of cynic behavior, and that an exemplary conduct should be the primary concern of the cynic philosopher. In short, the overlap in themes and overarching aim to provide a comprehensive view of all philosophy between the De Virtute and Julian's Oration 6 is considerable. And in addition, there is a possibility that here Julian was responding to specific arguments, as we can read in the De Virtute. In particular, the possibility to walk different roads of philosophy as it best suits, the remark about philosophers going off roads and possibly the Stoics, and the different takes on the role of hostile criticism in the Cynic philosopher's behavior appear as some of the links that connect the two works. In short, the question is whether Oration 6 could be understood as a remake of the similarly ambitious De Virtute. To sum up, the De Virtute is a philosophical oration that Themistius pronounced in front of individuals, possibly students, whom he claimed had trained in Aristotle and Plato. The contents of the De Virtute, however, appear unusual given what we know about Themistius, in that the author provides a particularly sympathetic view of Cynic philosophy. The oration does not provide any clear indication about chronology, and I have tentatively suggested that the early months of 362, when Julian was in Constantinople and pronounced two speeches dealing with Cynic philosophy, provide a plausible scenario in which Themistius could have delivered the Virtute. If this is the case, Themistius seems to have been especially receptive of Julian's philosophical arguments as they were publicly expressed in Oration 7 against Heraclius. But he attempted to supply a more comprehensive intellectual framework that could accommodate and justify Julian's take on cynicism, and especially so if it was in front of a broader audience who, like Themistius and like-minded individuals, may not have been so keen on syncretism as Julian was. I wonder whether the De Virtute may have been an attempt to build and to systematize the philosophical input received from the oration against Heraclius, but on yet another occasion, this was not good enough for Julian, who a few days before leaving Constantinople did not miss the chance to remake what Themistius had done. If this was the case, the De Virtute might witness another chapter in the relationship between Themistius and the Emperor Julian.